With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the California Weed Science Society is accepting scholarship applications. We'll have details for you. But our top story today, experts say our milk supply remains safe despite an unusual outbreak of bird flu. Trace amounts of the bird flu virus that has affected dairy cows has been found in milk. However, experts around the nation agree that the milk supply remains safe for human consumption. The FDA and USDA say that's because of two reasons: the pasteurization process and the diversion or destruction of milk from sick cows. U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack in a call with agriculture reporters on Wednesday.
Well, just to be clear about this, it's not surprising that a virus could be found in a pasteurized sample. The question is whether or not the virus is live in that sample. All right. So in other words, you can find particles of the virus after pasteurization, because pasteurization is not sterilization. It doesn't necessarily remove every evidence of a virus. But what it does is it kills the capacity of the virus to be infectious. And that's what you're concerned about. The concern is there a live virus in that milk? And the pasteurization samples that have been done up to this point on milk that has contained virus has resulted in the virus not being live.
Berent Nelson of the American Farm Bureau Federation agrees.
Number one, their milk is safe to drink. Sick cows are pulled out of the herd, so their milk is not allowed to enter the supply chain. Further, pasteurization kills both bacteria and viruses. This includes high path avian influenza, so their milk is safe to drink.
While pasteurization inactivates the virus, the process is not expected to remove the presence of viral particles. That's why these inactive trace amounts were found. Meanwhile, to further protect the U.S. livestock industry from the threat posed by highly pathogenic H5N1 avian influenza, USDA is taking a number of actions with federal partners to help get ahead of the disease and limit its spread. USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service announced a federal order requiring the following measures, effective Monday, April 29th, starting with the mandatory testing for interstate movement of dairy cattle. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
The mandatory testing for interstate movement impacts and involves dairy cattle. We're going to initially focus on lactating cows. It doesn't necessarily mean that the order is limited only to lactating cows, but it means that we'll start there because that is the place where we think we've seen the most intersection with the H5N1 and the most intersection with the movement of cattle that have resulted in the spread of this in other states.
USDA also announced mandatory reporting of positive test results. Laboratories and state veterinarians must report positive influenza A serology diagnostic results in livestock to USDA APHIS. On the mandatory reporter side, Vilsack says it's important for animal health officials to get information about all cattle.
So if there's a H5N1 finding in other cattle, we obviously will need to know about it as soon as possible. So that's the distinction in terms of interstate movement.
USDA has identified spread between cows within the same herd, spread from cows to poultry, spread between dairies associated with cattle movements, and cows without clinical signs that have tested positive. In other news, the Agriculture Department is working with tribal nations in self-determination regarding food and natural resources. Rod Bain explains.
The latest in a series of annual consultations and listening sessions continues previous collaborative efforts between the Agriculture Department and tribal nations. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack recently told members of the North American Agricultural Journalists Organization prior to the late April consultations that three critical points are the focus of tribal self-determination and USDA tribal relations. First,
I think there are opportunities in which we can be respectful of the nation-to-nation status. We can be respectful of tribes' desires to be more self-determinant in the area of their food programs, and whether or not we can encourage greater self-determination in the food programs and making sure that food that is served in those programs represents the food that tribes are interested in and believe is in the best interest of tribal members.
In the realm of food safety,
as we see an expansion of tribal processing of bison and other indigenous animals, that then leads to the question of the inspection process and how is that going to work. And I think we have a model between the U.S. and states, where states basically say we would prefer to have, so long as the products don't cross state lines, we have an arrangement. I think that a similar type of opportunity is available for conversation with the tribes.
And there is also continued relationship between USDA and tribal nations regarding our nation's forest.
We've seen a dramatic increase in co-stewardship opportunities. What more can be done in that space?
Consultations have included additional topics such as research and education, conservation connected to farming and ranching, economic development, and trade. Of interest regarding trade is a first-ever USDA-led agricultural trade mission for tribal nations. The June event is to be held in Vancouver, British Columbia. According to Secretary Vilsack,
it's a reflection of our philosophy relative to trade, which is there are a multitude of ways in which you can increase and enhance trade, one of which is to have more promotions, more partnerships, more people, more personnel, more presence in markets. And this is an opportunity for us to sort of develop a kind of a special niche market in a country, Canada, where there will be, I think, interest in what we have to sell. So it's an opportunity to expand economic opportunity in those tribal areas. It's an opportunity for tribes to better understand the nuances of exports. It is similar to what we're doing with specialty crops, in which we are putting more resources into trade promotion and diversifying our markets.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, USDA has announced new nutrition standards for school meals. Gary Crawford reports.
After reviewing over 136,000 comments and more than 50 listening sessions, the Agriculture Department's come out now with a new set of nutrition standards for school meals, standards that will put limits on sodium and on added sugars in foods and in flavored milk.
I think all of this is designed to ensure that students have quality meals and that we meet parents' expectation that their children receive healthy and nutritious meals at school.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack telling reporters schools will have plenty of time to meet the standards.
It takes time to transition, to phase in a number of the aspects of this new rule. And so you'll see a series of phasing in over the course of the fall of 25 to the fall of 27.
Vilsack said many schools are already meeting the standards, and he pledged help and flexibility for those schools that are having trouble. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's the livestock report. What are the latest trends in inventory of cattle in feedlots per USDA's latest monthly look? Rod Bain tells us.
More cattle in feedlots than this same time last year.
The number of cattle on feed on April 1st was about 11.8 million head, which was about 1% above a year ago.
Yet as USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum delves into further details from the April cattle on feed report, he indicates
this report showed a decline in placements, which was below what a number of industry analysts were expecting,
with March placements at 1.75 million head of cattle,
which was about 12% below 2023. The low number of cattle being placed on feed reflects the fact that we are looking at increasingly tight supplies of cattle outside feed. We still remain in the contractionary phase of the cattle cycle.
A similar trend is noted for marketings of fed cattle in March.
During March, feedlots marketed about 1.7 million head of cattle, which was about 14% below a year ago. However, that has to be adjusted by the fact there were two fewer slaughter days during March. When you make those adjustments, the marketings on a per-day basis were actually about 5% below a year ago.
Of particular interest regarding trends of fed cattle marketings,
if we look at the marketing number, the number of cattle on feed over 150 days, which is sort of a marker of what we use to represent how fast cattle are being marketed, continues to grow well above a year ago as a proportion and as absolute numbers of cattle on feed, which is being reflected in the fact that the weights of cattle being slaughtered have been rather heavy.
Then there is the breakdown of cattle on feed by gender as of April 1st.
Which gives us an indication of the proportion of those animals on feed were heifers and heifer calves. And on April 1st, 2024, there were just under 4.6 million head of heifers and heifer calves on feed, which was about 1% above a year ago. But as a proportion of the number of total animals on feed was about 38.5% compared to about 38.7% a year earlier.
Steer and steer calf inventory in feedlots last month came in at over 7.2 million head, up 2% from the previous year. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Improving reproductive efficiency in a beef herd can be as easy as one trip through the chute. Chad Smith has details.
Dr. Joe Gillespie, professional services veterinarian with Boehringer Ingelheim, talks about how beef producers can better forecast calving season and related management with basic estrus synchronization.
The largest benefit of synchronization is getting calves born earlier in the season. And what that does to your cow herd is it does a couple of things. First, it actually increases weaning weights because calves are all weaned at the same time in the fall. So a younger calf, that is the number one factor that determines weaning weight. So if a calf is older and has more time to grow, he's going to weigh more. Second, it really narrows the calving season, which allows for producers to be a little more focused on their management. If you have a long 6-month calving season, it's hard to focus on doing a really good job and fine-tuning what you're doing with that group of cows. But if you have a 45 or 60-day calving window, you can focus more closely on that, and synchronizing them will allow that to happen more effectively.
Gillespie talks about how producers can introduce synchronization within their herd.
It can be as simple as one trip through the chute, giving a product that's called a prostaglandin. And those prostaglandins given to 100% of the cows will actually cause them to typically have an estrus cycle within 3 to 5 days after that synchronization. What you essentially do, instead of having a 21-day window where 100% of the animals may cycle, you may get that down to all the way around 10, 14 days. And that allows for the opportunity to get more of those cows pregnant in the front end or front loading that calving season. And if you get them closer together, you can manage them better.
There are other factors important for reproductive efficiency.
It's about proper nutrition, vaccinating animals, making sure that they're protected against any kind of venereal disease or diseases that could cause risk of fertility in those animals before they get exposed to the bull. Also, you can't forget about parasites and the impact of a parasite on the immune system, which can affect fertility. And then finally, if you're doing natural service, whether you're doing it with a synchronization program or without, breeding soundness exam on your bulls is really important because we can bring in fertility issues with the bull.
There are a lot of decisions to be made, so it's important to work closely with the veterinarian to put a plan in place.
We need to sit down with our veterinarian and develop a plan of how we're going to approach it. What's our nutritional plan? What's our vaccination? What's our goal with that vaccination? Do we need parasite control? Have we implemented a parasite control program? Finally, have we looked at our bulls that we're going to introduce to this herd? Together, we create a protocol that we can be effective with.
For more information, visit bicattlefirst.com. Chad Smith reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. With today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
More than 60 agricultural organizations have formed a new coalition aimed at safeguarding American farmers' access to essential crop protection tools. Led by Bayer, the Modern Ag Alliance advocates for legislative solutions ensuring consistency in labeling and maintaining domestic availability of farming innovations, specifically glyphosate. The group emphasizes science-based regulation and opposes state regulations conflicting with EPA determinations. The alliance aims to reinforce the safety and necessity of glyphosate as being essential for modern agriculture's sustainability. It aims to collaborate with policymakers and agricultural partners to uphold regulatory frameworks aligned with scientific understanding. The group's website, controlweedsnotfarming.com, highlights glyphosate's role in maintaining crop yields, competitiveness, and affordability for American farmers. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has introduced the first-ever national drinking water standard to safeguard communities from what it calls forever chemicals that are known as PFAS. The regulation setting maximum contaminant levels aims to protect against health issues linked to PFAS exposure, benefiting around 100 million people. However, the American Farm Bureau Federation has expressed concern about EPA's national primary drinking water regulation. AFBF President Zippy Duval said that while everyone wants safe and clean drinking water, the new regulation will disproportionately burden small communities with treatment costs, lacking the resources of larger metropolitan areas. In a press release, Duval stated, quote, "While we acknowledge the effort EPA has made in providing flexibility and support to small and rural systems, more needs to be done to lessen the burden of this rulemaking." The Department of Water Resources has announced another water allocation increase for the state water project. The allocation had been updated to 30% back in March, and the latest announcement now puts the SWP allocation at 40%. DWR reports that the update's based on an 800,000-acre-foot increase in storage at Lake Oroville and the expectation for an above-average snow runoff this spring. Currently, the statewide snowpack is approximately 99% of the historical average. The updated State Water Project allocation forecast anticipates delivery of 40% of requested supplies to contractors south of the Delta, 65% to contractors north of the Delta, and 100% for Feather River Settlement contractors. Snowpack, rainfall, and runoff information will continue to be assessed and taken into account for additional updates to water allocations. The California Weed Science Society is currently accepting applications for scholarship opportunities. Both undergraduate and graduate students with an interest in weed or invasive plant management are eligible to apply for the scholarships. Applicants must be pursuing a degree at an accredited two-year college or four-year university in California. All applicants need to submit three items to be considered for the scholarships: a resume stating current GPA, work experience, activities and honors, and a list of relevant courses taken, a statement of academic and career goals, and one letter of support from an academic advisor. Undergraduate and graduate students will be considered separately for each award between $1,000 and $2,000. The deadline to apply is May 24th, and more information is available at cwss.org/student-opportunities. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Are you getting a tax refund this year? One expert says we maybe put too much fun in that refund. A somewhat skeptical Gary Crawford has more.
Well, here's a song about a situation that many of us may be in right now as we start to prepare our tax return.
Creditors are breathing down my neck. I sure could use a refund check. Go to the CPA.
And you know, the guy there may have the right idea about what to do with that refund, which, even though it's our money in the first place, we still feel like this refund's a wonderful gift. It's from, yes, heaven. And when you find out you're getting that refund, you go,
"Oh, I want that money!"
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that right?
Exactly.
Lauren Jones is an Ohio State University Extension consumer policy expert. She teaches classes on things financial. And many of us love the idea of having that chunk of change in our pockets, burning a hole in those pockets, having a wild time with that money. Yes, it's there.
I want.
Yes, you do.
I want.
It's burning a hole.
I want everything I've ever seen in the movies.
I think a lot of people are easily tempted, myself included, to sort of do some fun spending out of that refund check.
And a little of that is okay. But Lauren Jones says that money comes to us, well,
it really represents a unique opportunity to do some important saving.
Saving? But no, she doesn't necessarily mean putting it in a savings account. Remember the song that we heard?
Creditors are breathing.
Well, Lauren Jones says in that regard,
paying down high-cost debt, such as credit card debt, is another form of saving. So you know, you could take the money and put it in a savings account where you'd be earning a very, very low interest rate, or you can take the money and pay down your credit card debt where you're sort of paying a much higher interest rate to hold that debt.
Now, maybe you don't have any credit card debt, and now, yes, you've got the money already, and there's stuff to buy and things to do and all. So Lauren says, do something about where most of that check's going to go before you even get it, before you even submit your taxes.
There's an option, a form that you can fill out to sort of pre-direct your refund into different accounts. So if you look for tax form 8888, it's a form that you can submit along with your taxes that will allow you to split your refund among several different accounts. Or you can use it to sort of buy savings bonds with some of your refund. You can use it to direct some of your refund directly into your IRA.
So that we can't go completely nuts and say,
I want everything I've ever seen in the movie.
Yes. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Here's an excerpt from an episode of the Voices of the Valley podcast, highlighting food safety from a producer and consumer standpoint.
Welcome to Voices of the Valley. My name is Kara Timmons. I am the communications manager at Western Growers.
Hi, and I'm Sonia Salas, AVP of Science at Western Growers.
Joelle Masso, AVP of Science Programs at Western Growers.
Today, we have two people uniquely qualified to talk about food safety and the food that we are giving our kids. So Joelle and Sonia are both food safety scientists, and they are also mothers. So we are here to talk about some of the things that are on a lot of our minds when we think about what we're giving our kids, what we're giving ourselves, and in terms of food safety and all of the things that are going on before food gets to our grocery stores. So Sonia, tell us a little bit about your background and your experience in food safety, as well as your experience as a mother.
Thank you for having us today. A little bit of me and my background, I can share that I'm an agronomist by training. I went to school and really focused on agricultural sciences, work with growers. And what has happened through my career is really that I focus on food safety, specifically produce safety. It's a passion of mine because of the value of fruits and vegetables in the diet of children. So I'm really happy today to offer some of the perspective I have with my career experience and working with the fresh produce industry on food safety issues and other topics.
Beautiful. Joel, same question.
So I grew up in an agricultural area, and my mom was a food scientist, so kind of connect it to my mom. And I've always recognized is that food is something that we most intimately share with everybody else. And so when I was growing up, that was kind of the culmination of science and food safety and agriculture was also just about public health and community. And so that's what brought me into it. I went to school for pathogenic microbiology and then pathogenic food microbiology for graduate school, and always had the intention of entering into the produce space for public health and food safety, and have spent a career trying to focus really on improvement when it comes to food safety and never kind of accepting status quo. So that's kind of my background with food safety and childhood evolution from talking about pathogens in food, actually cantaloupe, and when I was in junior high, and still talking about it today.
Both of you have children at different ages. So what does it look like through the lens of somebody who knows a lot about food safety and then is also now thinking about the diet of your children? What things do you think about? What things do you see other people and other mothers and other parents, other fathers thinking about that you wish that they knew more about?
So knowledge is power, but it's not everything we need. There are so many influences nowadays, so much information. Kids, as if you look at the statistics, CDC statistics, right? I think it was a couple years ago. I thought it was from 2 to 5 years old, a third of them are not eating a fruit or vegetable every week or daily when they did the study per week. So basically the numbers just show that there is not a good attitude towards fruits and vegetables, right? So from where I sit and what I try to do with my kids is deal with the same issues most parents gotta deal with. It's not easy to get to, you know, kids to eat vegetables and fruits, and And I think it, just because we got more knowledge about the nutritious value of the fresh produce that there are available, it doesn't mean our kids are going to automatically eat them. So what I can share is a challenge, the challenge of most parents, I believe, getting them to get used to vegetables and fruits. And I know that one thing we should always do is introduce them early in life. My kids now are, one is 6 and the other one is 11. So I tried, but you know, wasn't as successful as I wanted to. So now it's getting them in the process of preparing food, telling them about the benefits of fruits and vegetables, using food art to get them interested in the food. I really love resources like the Produce for Better Health Foundation, and also I believe the Produce Moms have recipes. They're wonderful for kids to grab their interest. But we all deal with different things, right? From my perspective, I try to adjust based on their age and what I can do to get them to enjoy fruits and vegetables. That's probably different from someone like Joelle with a toddler. You know, we all have different challenges as our kids grow. There's going to be a point where we can really influence more. So the sooner we do, the better for them, for their health. And the other thing, too, is they know what I do, so I share things that I learn. So they feel connected to our culture. So one thing we can do is get them to experience what other farmers, growers do, and so they can appreciate their food and where the food is coming from.
Yeah. So I have a toddler, as Sonia just said, and I think one of the advantages of a toddler is I control everything that gets on his plate. So right now he actually does consume quite a lot of fruits and vegetables. But I think specifically to answer to your question of like how parents are approaching what their kids consume and risks going into, you know, their kids' bodies, I think one thing that I have recognized as being like a risk manager is that so often we spend all of our time fixated on what is the tail or the high, you know, the least probable but worst outcome. And it gets really easy to spend all of your time and headspace into that. Well, if you're worried about contaminants or any kind of issue, is that you're always thinking about the riskiest scenario and you're probably forgetting about the majority of eating events that have nothing to do with those things. And if we flip-flopped the time where we're focused more on nutrition and getting higher quality food into our bodies and overall the impact on the totalistic health that somebody has, and I think that's really what I look to impart on my son as he grows up, is that it's really easy to get distracted with something that is either a headline or really clever marketing when it comes to other food products that may be more processed. I think that's one of the disadvantages when it comes to fruits and vegetables, is that you're competing against something with really, really flashy marketing. And that is extremely alluring to anybody, children or adults. And then conversely, it's also really challenging in a social space like we're in, where there's always some sort of travesty or issue that we're having to react to. And so I always just try to remember, it's like, that's the tail of the distribution. It's not the majority of the distribution. And try to stay level set with something that's a little bit more healthy mentally.
That again from the Voices of the Valley podcast. And don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have the statewide agriculture news at your convenience. Just search for the AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here is Brian German with this week's Almond Update.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. Senior Specialist of Industry Communications for the Almond Board, Taylor Hillman, talks to ABC's Director of North America and China Marketing, Laura Marine, about the successes of the partnership with Coach Prime, Deion Sanders.
Laura, we had kind of an unprecedented event around the big game, the Super Bowl, that happened back in February. With Coach Prime, of course, everyone's familiar with Coach Prime. Let's talk about everything that ended up happening. I mean, I know we talked about Radio Row and things leading up to the big game. What actually happened? What did he end up doing for us?
Well, we had an incredible presence with Coach Prime at the big game in Las Vegas. So this was the first time it's been played in Las Vegas. So the city was just completely taken over with fans and the excitement of the big game. And it was incredible to have Coach Prime there on behalf of California Almonds. We spent 6 hours with Coach Prime, and they were 6 well-used hours. We had 4 hours with him at Radio Row, and Radio Row is where all of the top-tier media comes. I mean, this is like all of the biggest sports shows and all of the biggest news channels are there at Radio Row. So this is not about just radio. This is literally all of the highest profile media that you can get in the United States is there, just generating coverage and stories. And so because of our partnership with Coach Prime, we were able to set up many, many interviews, one-to-one interviews with Coach Prime, where he was there talking about California almonds and their amazing exercise recovery benefits. So that was one huge part of our presence in Las Vegas. And then the second was an activation with consumers. So we had an event on Fremont Street, downtown Las Vegas, where we had a kind of tiny home, essentially, that was created for this. It had Coach Prime and almond signage all over it. And it was talking all about National Recover Day, where we declared February 12th, the day after the big game, National Recover Day. But it was a day to recover the way Coach Prime would want you to recover. So it's not about kicking back. It's not about, you know, relaxing. It is about, this is the first day of the off season. This is your day to start setting up what your off season looks like and to prepare to get you to the next level of what you want to do. And of course, that is recovering with almonds as a key part of that. So Coach Prime came to this event, spoke to hundreds of consumers, and really rallied them around this idea of National Recover Day. We were able to film so much content and get a lot of great footage that then we're leveraging across all of our social platforms nationwide.
Let's talk about some of the stuff he did too, because I know I saw him on ESPN's First Take passing out almonds, but there were other mainstream appearances for him where he was showcasing almonds and some of those recovery benefits. There's some kind of behind the scenes stuff too. He really liked the snack packs, I hear.
Oh yes, he loved the snack packs. So we created customized Coach Prime snack packs where they essentially say, eat your almonds, own your prime, and they feature Coach Prime himself. And he loved them. So he was giving them to everyone he was talking to. He even threw one to Stephen A. Smith on First Take. I don't know if you could see that, but then Stephen A. Smith actually put it into his suit coat pocket, which was amazing. So hopefully he ate those later. But then even when we were filming some of the footage in the tiny home, we asked Coach Prime to, you know, eat some almonds, and we had a big, beautiful bowl of almonds that, you know, we wanted him to eat from. And he said, he's like, you know, we like to keep things more natural around here. Those look too staged. So he's like, I want some other almonds. And then, so then they basically said, Coach, do you want your snack pack? He's like, yeah, give me my snack pack. Give me my snack pack. So he loved his snack pack. The other thing I would say that was kind of a fun behind the scenes thing was his almond chain. So we had that big almond chain that he wore in the TV ad that we did. And then we've created kind of small replicas of that just to have at different events throughout the course of the partnership. Well, we weren't really sure if Coach Prime would wear that at Radio Row, but we gave him one to go ahead and give to Dan Patrick. Dan Patrick was one of his first interviews that he had. So we gave it, we said, hey, this is for you to give to Dan Patrick. And he said, well, I'm wearing this. So he put it on and he wore it the entire time he was in Vegas, which really surprised all of us because we weren't sure that he would actually wear that. So that was
amazing.
Really cool too.
That is amazing. That's fun. Well, good. It seems, you know, we've talked about how this campaign has really returned more than we thought it would, you know, with the return on investment for ABC in this partnership. You actually have some data, some stats that we can talk about too. Now, I understand some of them are pretty impressive on the TV side because we got so many placements with the exposure on him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the things I think was most, they added so much value for this campaign was our TV buys. So you know, typically when you buy TV, you buy it based on the number of viewers that are expected to watch the different TV shows that you're advertising around. So we had planned and placed a lot of TV ads around CU Buffs games where Coach Prime was, you know, coaching and had such strong presence. Well, because so many people were watching the Buffs, so many more than people had ever estimated, what that means is for the TV that we purchased, it actually over-delivered by 43%. So when it gets to dollars, that means for every 1,000 people that we reached, we actually paid $4 less than what we had intended to spend. So when you add that up across the thousands and thousands and actually millions and millions of people we reached, that made our dollars go so much further.
Yeah, that's impressive. We are also talking about, you know, counting all of the times that Coach Prime hit on elevated prominent stories, right? Like big channels. And it was like 15, right?
Yeah. So actually, when we were at the Super Bowl, he generated 15 top tier placements for us. So that was just from his presence at Radio Row and all those amazing one-to-one interviews that he did. When you look at our campaign with him in totality, which is still running and which will still be running through April 30th, we've generated a total of 108 placements with him. So that's 108 stories about Coach Prime and California Almonds. And just for some comparison, if you were going to compare that back to previous spokespeople that we've used that are celebrities and are well known, that number is about 5.5 times higher than what we've generated in the past. So that's incredible. And then when you layer on how high profile the media has been, that's also been something that we've never really experienced before. So compared to previous spokespeople, we are generating about 400% more high profile media coverage than we did in previous campaigns. So not only is the quantity of placements higher, but the quality is as well. So it's been really impactful for us.
Again, ABC's Laura Marine, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Taylor.
You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now for more news. The Agriculture Department has announced an investment that could help bring fresh and healthful food to places where such foods can be hard to find, and it also could help farmers at the same time. Gary Crawford has more.
Most of us can easily go to our local supermarket and find just about any fresh and healthful food that there is. But in this country today, there are still places where people don't have easy access to fresh, healthy foods, such as fruits and vegetables. However, there is a lot of work going on to change that, work that will also help the farmers who grow those foods. The latest development coming this past week in an announcement from Deputy Agriculture Secretary Social Torres-Small, who told reporters,
USDA Rural Development and the Reinvestment Fund are announcing the selection of 16 partnerships that will receive more than $40 million in grants under the Healthy Food Financing Initiative Partnerships Program to expand access to nutritious and affordable foods in 20 states and in Washington, D.C.
Grants will be used by local organizations to do such things as establishing new local markets and local supply chains and helping local food retailers to offer more fresh produce for their customers. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says this is just part of a huge effort to give consumers more access to healthful foods and to give local farmers more access to nearby markets, an effort that includes
establishing regional food business centers, investing over $300 million in local agricultural marketing initiatives, establishing resources in partnership with states, nearly $700 million invested in states under our regional food system infrastructure effort. We've had local food purchasing agreements where we're creating the opportunity for local opportunities for schools, for food banks to basically sell to a small and mid-sized producer in the region, in the locality, as opposed to a large-scale distributors. We're creating farm-to-school commitments across the board. And finally, we've essentially invested billions of dollars in our procurement efforts as we try to deal with the issue of dealing with food insecurity, encouraging those resources that are going into food banks to come from as much as they can from local regional food producers.
So people who live in some of the most remote parts of the country don't have to travel so far from home to find fresh, healthy food.
And farmers don't have to ship their products hundreds of miles just to find buyers for those crops. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA this week announced funding awards through two rural development programs designed to promote clean energy production and use. Here's Rod Bain with details.
Two clean energy programs under USDA's rural development umbrella now have funding allocated for more than 700 clean energy projects. Rural Development Undersecretary Basil Gooden notes projects in 35 states and Puerto Rico are recipients of $194 million in Rural Energy for America program grants.
REAP is one of our most oversubscribed programs. That program is designed to invest in renewable energy projects or technologies.
While awards through the Higher Blends Infrastructure Incentives Program includes $43 billion in grants to projects in 15 states for infrastructure improvements at fueling stations and terminals. Applications for funding for both programs are being accepted through September 30th, with more information available at www.rd.usda.gov. Click the tab to Programs and Services, then the link to Energy Programs. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.